Media Network Plus. Produced and presented by Keith Perron.
We begin today's program in Cook Islands. The Cook Islands government believes it is close to finalizing a submarine cable link up through French Polynesia. At the beginning of this year, the New Zealand government met with Niue and the Cook Islands to try to develop plans to improve digital communications. It had initially been planned that both countries, along with Tokelau, would join the proposed $300 million U.S. Hawaiki cable connecting Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, or an expanded Southern Cross cable. Now, in search of a more cost-effective connection, the Cook Islands Finance Minister Mark Brown told Don Wiseman they are in discussions to join as an of yet unnamed cable from Samoa and linking to Hawaii via French Polynesia.
Still in conjunction with New Zealand, but also having discussions with French Polynesia and the telecom company involved in providing service in French Polynesia, OPT. And at the moment, still finalizing details of a connection to a cable that will be, at this stage, linked from Samoa to French Polynesia.
Is that a link that takes you anywhere very much?
Yes, then it hooks up to the major cables going through Hawaii and then onto the rest of the world.
How big a difference will that make for a place like Cook Islands?
Well, connecting onto a submarine cable, you know, provides significant bandwidth availability for the business community, for the telecommunications community, for all sorts. And it provides huge economic benefits for business and for individuals. You know, the studies have demonstrated many times that connection to, you know, significant bandwidth at a good price has a huge impact on GDP growth, has a huge impact on the opportunity to expand education services, health services, and all sorts of things.
At the moment, in terms of digital technology, what the Cook Islands has is via satellite. Is that the case?
Yeah, all of our internet connectivity to the rest of the World Wide Web is through satellite communication. It's very expensive, and there's also some technical features that are not as advantageous as if you would with cable. So we've always been looking at the opportunity to have cable connection, and this particular project that we've been working with the New Zealand government and trying to get cable connectivity for not just the Cook Islands but also for Niue as well is coming around at an opportune time for us. It's a very good opportunity for us, and we're in the middle of some negotiations right now with the different parties that are involved.
What's it likely to cost Cook Islands?
Well, we've had studies done in the last couple of years, but I think we'd be looking at the vicinity of about $30 million for a cable connection for the Cook Islands.
You'd budget for that over the life of the cable?
Well, of course, you'd work out your financials on an investment like that and, you know, determine what the returns would be to meet any borrowing costs and so forth. But there are all sorts of financing opportunities that are available to us through development finance that New Zealand will make available. There's also our borrowing ability as a sovereign country, but there's also the opportunity for equity stakeholders to also invest in the cable as well.
Why hasn't the Cook Islands then been looking at this Hawaiki cable, which is coming a lot more closely to the Cook Islands, isn't it?
Not really. We've been looking at Hawaiki. Hawaiki were part of the initial discussions earlier on this year when we met with cable companies and viewed their proposals.
So it's just not a good enough deal for you?
Well, it comes down to cost. At the end of the day, it's not to say that we won't have anything to do with Hawaiki. As I said, discussions are still ongoing with our current preferred partners, and until things are confirmed, the opportunities for other cable companies are still there.
That was Mark Brown, Cook Islands Finance Minister, speaking to Don Wiseman about putting a cable from Samoa linking Hawaii and French Polynesia. You're listening, of course, to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Now, something, of course, that we have discussed on the program before is war journalism or war reporting or working as a war correspondent. Now, going back to World War I, one of the big things involving war journalism was, of course, photography. In the early decades, photography was, well, it wasn't exactly easy. You had to carry a large amount of very heavy equipment, and sometimes you had to take all sort of pictures in difficult situations, never knowing if the picture would develop correctly. Now, in the last few years, we've seen massive changes in technologies, even with soldiers capturing images on their smartphone. But the question, though, is even with the technology changes, has war photography changed at all? Well, has it just changed a bit, or is it still exactly the same? Well, Anna Wilkes Tucker is a curator of photography at the Museum of Fine Arts in Austin, Texas, in the United States. And she wrote a book called War Photography: Images of Armed Conflict and Its Aftermath. She speaks next to Richard Ady.
The photography has changed technically, of course, from when the photographers had to have a darkroom along with him to where they could have an image on air 7 seconds after they took it. The technology of armaments has changed, so the distance of the photographers has changed with that. But a large part of our project was devoted to the idea that there are certain inherent stages in armed conflict that photographers have photographed that don't change across time, across culture, across faith, across tribes, that there is a relationship between this entity called war and this entity called photography that has variation but also has pattern.
I will come back to that, because I think it's the real truism that emerges from both what I've heard about the exhibition and certainly what is in the book that goes with it. But I am also interested in what's changed. So in the early days, and there's an image from the Second Opium War in China from 1860, photographers obviously couldn't capture movement then. The technology
Correct.
Just wasn't up to it. So it's all about the aftermath then, isn't it?
The early pictures, well, portrait is the most common picture taken during warfare, because everybody wants to leave somebody with a portrait. And then trying to describe what's happening to others, photographers were left photographing the aftermath, whether it be dead on the battlefield or the destruction of property or the wounded or prisoners of war. All of these aspects that occur afterwards, because through the 19th century, a photographer needed a tripod, and somebody with a tripod is might as well have a red flag saying to snipers, "Here I am, come shoot me." And of course, the cameras and the films were not technically capable of recording action. So the Boer War is the first war with film camera, snapshot camera, and the submachine gun. So, and then, of course, World War One is things even advance even further.
And one of the effects of that, those early limitations, is that I think more photos were staged. But has that ever gone away? Or do we still have,
No, no, there's still controversy. I just served on the World Press Photo Jury, and we had a lot of discussions about what photographers are and are not allowed to do to still be news, to still be factual. Because certain photographs are most desired by both the press and their audiences, it's just very tempting to come up with them even if you haven't. So there's a photograph in the exhibition of some men who look like they're charging the battlefield. They're actually charging the cookhouse. And there's a famous photograph which is supposed to be dueling a pilot from a biplane falling out of the plane that is in flames, and it's actually a toy plane. So you have to be careful. You have to consider, has the photographer totally faked or even substantially altered the picture? Has it crossed some line of factualness that is important?
Yeah, the other thing, and that gets us into something related, I think, is that photo I mentioned a moment ago by Felice Beato, one of the very first war photographers, and he allegedly called the scene beautiful. And that gets into an issue that must come up again and again. Is it reportage? Is it art?
Well, I'm not willing to make that dichotomy. I think that reportage can be an exquisitely beautiful photograph. And in fact, one of the great tensions of the exhibition, for instance, there's a Ken Jarecki photograph of an Iraqi soldier in the Gulf War who has been burned, completely burned, while in his truck when his truck was bombed. And there's a tension, there's a push-pull standing in front of the photograph because the tonalities, the everything that is aesthetic about the picture is pulling you in, and what you are looking at is pushing you away. And that's one of the complexities that are important to the power of the photograph.
One thing I'm really interested in is how you grouped the pictures. They're in themes. So there's, you know, beforehand, there's patrol and troop movements, there's the aftermath, there's civilians in grief, all those different categories, more besides. Why did you do it that way?
We worked 10 years on it. The first 3 or 4 years, we were the curators, the three curators, myself, Will Michaels, and Natalie Zelt. We traveled and we came to the Australian War Memorial and the National Gallery of Australia, and we interviewed photographers in Australia. We went to the Imperial War Museum in London. We went to museums and collections in Spain and all over the United States, France. And we'd look at images all day, and then at night we would talk about what images were still in our mind. Say we looked at 1,000 images in a day between us, and what images were still memorable. And then we began to make lists of those, and then we began to compare them, and we realized there were patterns and things that were reoccurring, such as a woman grieving at a graveside, and aftermath and medical issues. Then we, at this stage, we invited in military historians, and they said, look, the patterns that you're setting up are actually patterns that we in the military work with and engage in, and in our plans and in our training, and that these are inherent stages for armed conflict. So it seemed to us that that was something that we hadn't previously seen discussed or recognized. And that's when we added the slash in the title, that the show is about war and its inherent nature and photography and its engagement with war. And it was only at the last stages that we realized that these patterns could be organized in the rough order of war, so that someone going through the book or going through the exhibition is seeing the evolution of engagement of the combatant through the eyes of photographers.
This is the Media Report, the Anzac Day edition on RN. I'm Richard Adie, and you're hearing from Anne Wilkes Tucker, curator of photography at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, Texas. She's the driving force behind a remarkable exhibition and book, War Photography, Images of Armed Conflict and Its Aftermath. And I put it to her that what this collection makes clear is that despite changes in time and place and in technology, that war is always brutal, bloody and terrible.
And the human costs are extraordinary. And that's why we put civilians, have sections on civilians and children as well, because we didn't just want it to be the combatants. They are not the only people affected in situation of armed conflict. But there's also humor and hope and some relief in the exhibition. There is a man who's using his gas mask to peel onions, and there are servicemen letting off steam by wrestling each other or throwing up a comrade in the air. So we tried to show that it's not all horror. We tried to show courage. We tried to show skill, reconnaissance, and other aspects of that are involved in it. We showed the behind the lines support, the people who have to supply the bread and the shoes and the plans. We just tried to not just focus on fighting. It's just one section, but to show all the complexities. There's a section on faith. We wanted people to understand the complexity of it. And one of the things that pleased us the most was some veterans organizations in Houston requested an evening when the veterans could bring their families, because some of the veterans apparently found it easier to talk about their experiences through the photographs. And that was, for me, that was wonderful, that if we could make that easier for them, then great.
Actually, that leads me to something I've been really fascinated by since I first looked at the book, and that is, this was a 10-year process for you. How has putting it together affected you? Because it must have affected you.
Well, there were certainly nights when each of us individually, or on some nights altogether, didn't sleep well. We have seen man's capacity for inhumanity to his fellow man in extremes that it's just hard to comprehend. There are two separate pictures in the exhibition of armed people bayoneting unarmed people who are alive at the moment that they are being bayoneted. The section on executions is really hard, and I learned that executions are a standard way of killing people in wartime, and very seldom does it involve a trial that is a real trial with defense and evidence. And I learned a lot. That was the best part for me, is learning new photographers whose work I'd never encountered, histories of conflicts that I never knew about. The power of photography was reaffirmed for me. I am changed by this experience. I am more in awe of the photographers who believe that it is important for these pictures to be made. We lost two of the photographers during the exhibition. Chris Andros and Tim Hetherington were killed in Libya. But the photographers were some of the smartest people I've ever met. They knew the issues. They knew the players. They knew the risk. They were smart about evaluating those risks and when to get out. Sometimes it didn't work out. So there was just an expanse of knowledge that was previously not within my realm of experience.
And what has been... Actually, I'll ask you another question before I do that. There's a comment in the catalogue from Pulitzer Prize winner David Leeson, who said he was searching for but never found a series of photos or a single one that could end war. And I'll just quote. He says, "I still really believe there's a photograph worth dying for, but can you find it? I never did." It's a remarkable thing to say, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I was stunned when I first read it. Sure, photographers would. They'd love to make that picture. I'm not sure so many of them believe that that's possible. I came away from this believing that war is within us as human beings and that it will never go away. And I came away believing that wars don't end, that our fathers' wars are our wars and our wars are our children's wars. And the seeds of that lead to further wars. But there is greed and ambition and coveting and all those other things that bring us into conflict with each other. And I just don't see it ending. And part of the power of the exhibition, we had a wall what started as one wall at the end of the exhibition where anybody could write anything on a 3x5 card. It eventually expanded to three walls. So many people chose to write something. And they were heartbroken, I think, is one of the consensus of comments that we're capable of doing, but also when you see it across time, when you see the same thing happening again and again and again and again across country, across time, across faith, it is sobering and saddening.
That was Ann Wilkes Tucker, curator of photography at the Museum of Fine Arts in Austin, Texas, in the United States. She's also the author of a book called War Photography, Images of Armed Conflict and Its Aftermath. And she was speaking there with Richard Ady. Now, a few weeks ago, you may remember that we were going to present Program 4 in our continuing series from the Radio Netherlands Archives. Well, that program, the two transmissions, didn't go out because of a technical glitch at our relay station. We are rescheduling this for the 20th and 21st. That is next week. Not next week, but the week after. We will have the details posted at our website, www.pcjmedia.com, in the next 48 hours after listening to this program. So we will finally bring you Program 4 of PCJ Radio International Presents from the Radio Netherlands Archives. And the program that we actually had scheduled that week that it didn't go out was on Eddie Start. We have some very rare Eddie Start material, including a full 80-minute edition of Happy Station. And the program is presented by Paulette McCrory. So do check out our website and also the Facebook page for PCJ Radio International. Just do a search for PCJ Radio International and you will find it. All right, let's all have a small break. And when we come back, Glenn Hauser will be here with this week's Propagation. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
Hi, I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called the Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question. There's only one place. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There are various ways to catch the show. You can find it at my website at peteranthonyholder.com. Check out my blog at peteranthonyholder.blogspot.com. Find it at cyberstationusa.com, radioforall.net, or simply subscribe to it on iTunes. You've forgotten all those places already, haven't you? Okay, just Google the title. It's called the Stuff File Program, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. Catch it, enjoy it, and have a chuckle or two. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Radio will never be the same again.
Hi, my name's Colin Newell, and I'm the editor and creator of DXR.ca. Since the mid-90s, DXR.ca has been the go-to website for timely resources for the DXR, SWL, and broadcast listener. If you're looking for unbiased reviews of the most modern receivers and antennas, or are interested in participating in some of the more lively online forums all about radio, then come on by. DXR.ca, a world band radio website.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Glory 105, which is PDF 222 journal.
Speed 220, Glory 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
All right, and of course you are listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Sounded like I was going to pause there, only because I actually forgot what I was completely going to say. But anyway, I do remember. And it's now, of course, time to look at propagation, what has been happening, and what we can expect. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through November 12th. Normal to fair at low latitudes, fair to normal at mid latitudes, fair to poor to normal to fair at high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through November 12th, magnetic conditions unsettled to active, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, geomagnetic activity increasing November 12th and 13th, with unsettled to active conditions gradually developing, along with a chance of isolated G1 minor storm intervals. From Peter Coleman in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled on November 11th, 14th, 19th, 27th, and 28th. Quiet to active November 12th, 13th, 20th, and 24th. Mostly quiet on November 15th through 18th, 29th, and 30th. Active to disturbed November 21st to 23rd, 25th, and 26th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field unsettled to active November 10th to 15th and 19th to 30th, with G1 minor geomagnetic storm levels likely on November 12th and 13th, with ANK indices peaking at 20 and 4. G2 moderate geomagnetic storm levels likely on November 21st and 22nd, peaking at 54 and 6. Lowest ANKs of 5 and 2 on November 16th to 18th. Solar flux ranging only from 75 to 79 through December 3rd. RSGB says for meteor scatter enthusiasts, start preparing for the major shower for this month, the Leonids, peaking on Thursday the 17th around 10:30 UT. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, microwave DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting off the coast of Angola, November 14th and 15th. Somewhat extreme all week along the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. Off northwest Australia, November 12th and 13th. Also across the Gulf of Carpentaria, the morning of November 13th.
All right, thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of the program. If you want to contact us, our email is mnp@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.